Today is Monday, November 2nd, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Carl. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. I'm doing well.
Great. Carl, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you have my permission.
Thank you so very much. Carl, what year were you born?
I was born in 1953.
Where?
In a town called LaPorte, Indiana.
L-A-P-O-R-T-E?
Yep. Sometimes with a space between the two, sometimes not.
Okay. What were your folks doing there?
They had lived there all their lives.
Wow.
And my dad was a draftsman, and my mom was a homemaker.
Okay.
And I was the first of four kids, and basically the entire clan practically lived there in LaPorte, and it had been my mom's family had been there for at least a generation. I'm not sure how long my dad's family had been there.
Okay. Were they farming?
No. No, my maternal grandfather worked for the New York Central Railroad. He was a telegrapher and I don't know what you call it, but the guy who runs the signals.
Okay.
For the train. My maternal grandfather was a mechanical engineer / tinkerer and also ran a farm and orchard. And the impression I got from my dad was that the farm and orchard was what got them through the Great Depression.
Wow. Yeah. How did your folks meet?
I don't know. I think that they were in elementary school together. So
wow.
My guess is that they were classmates at some point. So
okay. Do you think they went to the same high school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they did. Graduated the same year.
All right. So high school sweethearts.
Yep. Yep. Although I do get the impression it was kind of off again, on again, too. So
okay. All right.
They didn't decide in second grade to get married or anything like that. But eventually, they got around to it.
Okay. LaPorte, is that North Indiana, Central, South Indiana?
It's in the northwest corner of the state. When I was little, I have very vague recollections of going to the beach up at Lake Michigan.
Okay.
And we would run into Chicago periodically to go to the Field Museum of Natural History there.
Oh, wow.
I clearly remember the Charles Knight murals painted on the wall of prehistoric animals and all that kind of stuff in the dining hall that they had.
Wow. Okay.
A friend of mine who's a curator of paleontology there now talks about what a hassle those things are because they're historic now. And they're trying to preserve them, and they're just painted on the wall in what was a dining hall.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. That's got to be a challenge for them.
Yep.
Yeah. So growing up in Indiana, did you learn to swim in the nearby rivers, or how did that work out?
Actually, we didn't stay all that long. We left. I went to kindergarten and a little bit of first grade, and then Dad got a new job in Baltimore, and so we moved to Baltimore, Maryland. He was working at that point for Martin Marietta, one of the big aerospace companies.
Okay.
We lived in Baltimore just for a year and a half, and that was my fault. The humidity didn't agree with me, and I had just one sinus infection after another.
Oh, wow.
And so he got a transfer to Martin's plant in Littleton, south of Denver, Colorado. And so we moved to Denver.
Lots drier there.
So.
Okay. And suddenly there's mountains in your landscape there.
It was something that they never said it, but I've often wondered if I was an excuse. We'd done a trip to Colorado, gosh, when I was about 4 or 5, and they just loved it.
Wow.
So I remember I was in third grade at the time, finding out that we were moving to Denver and literally jumping up and down with excitement that we were going to be going to Colorado.
Wow. Okay.
That was a big deal.
Do you think that trip when you were 4 or 5 going to Colorado, you think that was the first time your folks had been west out of Indiana?
It was, well, no.
Okay.
My dad had gone west on a troop train. He was in the Korean War in the Navy.
Okay.
I don't know just how much sightseeing he did. I know he was in the San Francisco area, and they came into Los Angeles right after a fairly good-sized earthquake in San Bernardino.
Hmm.
But he wasn't really on his own. My mom and a girlfriend of hers, after they got out of high school, had done a number of trips out west. They'd taken one trip to Colorado, taken another trip to Yellowstone, and had my mom not gotten married, I think next up was Yosemite.
Okay.
So they'd both been west before.
Okay.
But not a whole lot.
So it sounds like your parents might have been jumping up and down for joy as well with you when you got transferred out to Littleton.
Yep. It was pretty happy.
Okay.
And they were kind of adventuresome. They were, you know, the rest of the family all kind of hung out there around Lake Michigan. I had an uncle that was a professor at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, somebody else at Milwaukee, and then everybody else was in La Porte. And so for us to haul off and move way out west was pretty exciting.
Yeah. Okay. And this was, let's see, so you were born in 53, so this would have been 57, 58-ish?
Let's see. Would have been close to about 1959, 1960, I believe.
Okay.
Because I remember I was in fifth grade when Kennedy got assassinated, and we've been there for 3 years, give or take. So.
Okay. And where did you go to high school?
Went to high school in New Mexico. So basically what happened was my dad was working for Martin Marietta. They were one of the big, and still are, one of the big aerospace contractors.
Right.
And the tradition in that industry, so to speak, is that whoever got the contract hired a bunch of people, and whoever didn't get the contract laid off a bunch of people.
Hmm.
And so Martin Marietta was in line to build what they called the Titan IV.
Okay.
But instead, North American Rockwell got the contract for the Saturn V. So, as the moon rocket. And so Martin laid off everybody, and North American Rockwell was hiring up everybody, but my folks decided that they didn't want to keep moving around that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad eventually did get laid off by Martin, took a temporary job in Albuquerque, and while he was waiting, and got his security clearance and went to work for the Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory, as it was called then.
Yeah.
And, so in 1965, we moved to Los Alamos. And then.
Okay, now I got a zillion questions for you about Los Alamos, but before we get there,
mm-hmm.
let's go back to Colorado, your grade school years. Did you guys spend any time like up in Rocky Mountain National Park or Brainerd's Lake or Long's Peak Country or Estes Park or
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
My folks love the mountains, and we would every Sunday we would go up someplace.
Wow.
Sometimes we would go up, you know, Trail Ridge Road, the Peak to Peak Highway. We would go down into South Park and Fairplay. We'd take our old Falcon station wagon and bounce it over these ungodly roads, over some of the old passes and that kind of stuff.
With you've got three siblings. What are their names, and how old, different were they from you?
Okay. I'm the oldest, and then I have a sister, Cecilia, who's 18 months younger than I am. And so she was along with me on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then a brother, Eric, who is 8 years younger than I am.
Okay.
And he was born a few months after we moved to Colorado. And then my youngest sister, Martha, was born 6 weeks before we moved from Denver to Los Alamos.
Okay.
So so it was when we were up bouncing around in the mountains, Eric was just a baby.
Right.
And my mom had built this carrier for him that was basically a bunch of blankets with a shoulder strap that my dad could carry.
Oh, wow.
And like a sling. And we'd be, you know, up there in this howling wind, and people would say, "What's in there?" And Dad would unwrap it and reveal this little baby inside.
Oh, cool.
Their amusement. So, and it was also, you mentioned Brainerd Lake, and that's where I learned a very, very important lesson. My dad and a friend of his and I had gone up there hiking one time, and Dad said, "Well, I think it's about time to head back." And I was, I don't know, probably about eight or something like that. But I said, "Oh, no, let's keep going. Let's keep going." And he said, "Well, we have to walk back." Yeah, I know, but let's keep going. I want to hike some more. So he let me hike as long as I wanted to. And then we turned around, and he wouldn't carry me or anything. I wanted to walk that far. I had to walk back. And so after that, when Dad said he thought it was time to turn around, I'd say, okay.
Nice.
Lesson learned.
Were you good about that? When your dad, you know, would let you learn lessons that way, it would sink in well?
Yeah, I think so.
Nice. Did you guys camp out?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We my mom hated camping, but they wanted us to travel. They wanted us to see the world, and that's what they could afford. And so, when we lived in Baltimore, every weekend we went to like Washington or Annapolis or something like that. They didn't intend to stay there long, but they wanted us to know everything that was there.
Wow.
They drug us out of, you know, if it had marble columns in front of it, we went there. And then in Colorado, it was, we would go to the museums and stuff in Denver, but mostly climbing around up in the mountains. And then we'd have 2 1-week trips on Dad's vacation every summer where we'd go someplace further afield, like Yellowstone or Dinosaur or Mesa Verde or something like that.
Did you get over to Grand Canyon on those 1 week trips?
We didn't when we lived in Colorado. After we moved to Los Alamos, we did.
Okay, for high school. What do you remember about those 1 week long campout trips?
They were a lot of fun. I generally don't have like real comprehensive memories of them, but various things, you know, stand out, like when the bear got into our ice box when we were in Yellowstone and my mom was freaking out, or when my baby brother found a dead mouse under the tent when we camped at Dinosaur, stuff like that. But I think it did, you know, it did give us a real appreciation for all the different things that were out there.
Nice. Nice. So you started putting some of the landscape of the West together.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
From the back of a station wagon.
Yep. Yeah. And
okay.
it was actually on the trip to Dinosaur National Monument was the first time that I thought it might be fun to be a ranger.
Really?
Yeah. So it was...
Did you guys interface with rangers? Did you go to a ranger talk or program?
Oh yeah. We would go to the campfire program, and sometimes go on the guided walks and that kind of stuff. But since we were in the campgrounds, and of course, Mission 66 was in full swing in those days, so we had very nice new campgrounds, and we would always go to the evening talks and that sort of thing.
So Dinosaur National Monument. Has some incredible backcountry, but is mostly known for its front country quarry.
Mm-hmm.
Was that where you guys were? Was at the quarry and then maybe camping at the campground there next to the banks of the Colorado River?
Yeah, I've pretty much always been interested in paleontology.
Okay.
And so that was kind of a trip for me to begin with.
Ooh.
And so we started out with a quarry. We camped there at the Split Mountain Campground, which was a picnic area that might be a campground again. I'm not sure, but right there at the mouth of Split Mountain Canyon by the Green River. And then while we were there, besides the quarry, we went up to Echo Park and drove around to the Gates of Lodore.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of stuff as well. So,
okay.
So during the week that we were there, it wasn't part of another trip. Dinosaur was the destination.
Nice. It's a big area. Just as you mentioned, Echo Park and Gates of Lodore, that you could spend a couple of days just driving around, making that happen.
Yep.
Neat. And so you mentioned paleontology. Did you get interested in dinosaurs at an early age?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We back in the day, Dad always had to buy gas at the Sinclair station because they always had, some dinosaur tchotchkes that they were giving out. So I had all the little stamp books, and I had a huge box of plastic dinosaurs, which disappeared somewhere along the way. And my mom would drill me on the name. She'd read the name that was stamped into the tail, and I'd have to tell her what it was. And so I still don't know the right pronunciations for everything.
Stegosaur and all the brontosaur and things.
Yep.
So, oh my gosh.
So that was kind of my trip.
Okay. And that was burning bright clearly when you guys moved to Los Alamos.
Yeah, by the time we'd moved to Los Alamos, it was getting I was still interested but not consumed anymore.
Okay.
Although I think it did whet my appetite for science just in general.
Okay.
And of course, Los Alamos is a good place for that.
Oh my gosh. So let's work on this timeline a little bit. This is 1965 that you moved to Los Alamos.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to drop some names here. The Cernicek family, the Yaman family, the Maslin family. Let's see, who else? The Zemock family. Do any of those names ring a bell?
Mr. Cernicek was my German teacher.
Okay.
A
Fretwell, Stretch Fretwell.
Nope.
All right.
Yeah, so...
So Mr. Cernicek, not just Dave Cernicek's dad, Mr. Cernicek was the German teacher?
And the Russian teacher.
Oh,
and
wow.
The Latin teacher. And if he could substitute for the French and the Spanish teachers, if they need be, he could... I may be off a little bit, but if I recall correctly, he could speak 11 languages and read 3 more.
Wow.
He was in the Czech underground during World War II, and he was just a kid. So his job was to be the bright-eyed kid who would hang around with the German soldiers and find out what new weapons were coming in, and then he would run back and report it to the to the underground, so the underground knew what they were up against.
Wow.
Eventually, they figured it all out. He was captured and thrown into a concentration camp. But I think he got tuberculosis, but got over it, maybe because he was so young or something like that. But anyway, he was released by mistake, and then, you know, got out of Dodge after that.
Wow.
So he'd picked up all of these languages working in the underground, and then just kept doing it. And I mean, you know, it was things like, okay, you know, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, you know, a bunch of related languages, and then lots of Slavic languages as well.
Wow.
So he was quite accomplished. So I, you know, what little German I still remember, I probably speak with a Czech accent.
There was a well-known Boy Scout post there called the Explorers Post 32, I think. I may be wrong on the number. Did you get into scouting? Did you get into that group?
I wasn't in that group. Excuse me. I was in Boy Scouts. I was working on, I think, yeah, the star badge. But then Driver's Ed was the same night as Boy Scouts. So I dropped out of Boy Scouts and went to Driver's Ed. But I was in Boy Scouts up to that point. I don't remember the troop name. Our troop leader was Jim Gallagher. I don't know why I remember that. But anyway, and we used to go hiking and camping in Bandelier. We did a winter camp out in January down there.
Ooh, what was that like?
Yeah, it was a one-night deal that was to teach us winter camping. And so, you know, we really worked to get ready for that one. And then
did you build a little igloo type thing out of snow?
No, not enough snow for that. But okay. We did, you know, put down newspapers for insulation under our tents and all that.
Okay.
They weren't definitely not of the, you know, ripping branches off fir trees to build a shelter or anything like that.
Okay.
Fortunately, we evolved beyond that point by the time I was in there. And then I think it was every summer. I only did it once, but I think every summer they did a backpacking trip into the Pecos Wilderness as well.
Oh, wow. What do you remember about that?
That I had the wrong kind of pack, and so it was just miserable. But we did have a lot of fun with our insect repellent because we found out that with a match, you could turn it into a flamethrower.
Oh, boy.
And so, you know, yeah, typical tweenage boy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. What were you interested in high school?
Mostly chemistry. When I got into high school, I took chemistry and just really ate it up and was doing so well that they pulled me out and put me into an accelerated study program, which basically was kind of like do your science fair project in a class.
Huh, okay.
So I was really into chemistry working in the lab, doing that kind of stuff. And then we had access to the libraries out at the lab.
Oh, wow.
At the Los Alamos lab. And we could set up appointments to meet with various scientists out at the lab as well. So that was all very cool. And part of it was my project, but a lot of it was just working with other people who were, you know, we were working on tons of different kinds of experiments and research projects and that kind of stuff.
Like what?
Well, my focus, so to speak, was on a class of plant pigments called anthocyanins.
How do you spell that?
A-N-T-H-O-C-Y-A-N-I-N. And
these are pigments. These are plant pigments.
Right. They're more famous today as antioxidants. but they're acid-base indicators. So they change color depending on the acidity of a solution.
Okay.
That's what makes apples red. As the apples ripen, they get more acidic, and it causes the anthocyanins in them to change from a blue-green color to a red color.
Okay.
Although peeling apples was too much work, and so I got my anthocyanins out of red cabbage, which all I had to do was boil and then purify, and then did a bunch of different pigmentation experiments, you know, see what it would work on, see how it behaved, and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
One gal in the lab that I was working with was working on transfer of intelligence by RNA, where she would train mice to run a maze, and then she would sacrifice the mice, extract the RNA from their brains, inject it into another mouse, and see if they learned to run the maze any faster.
Wow.
It kind of did, but as I recall, it was right on the edge of statistical significance.
Okay.
Had another guy that was working on explosives. He actually, when the teachers weren't looking, he actually made a little vial of nitroglycerin one time.
Oh, wow, that's exciting.
it was really, no, what are you doing? Had another gal that was working on hydroponics. She was growing tomatoes and just water and nutrients. So it was a lot, you know, it wasn't just chemistry that we were doing in the lab. There was a lot of different things going on. And so it was a lot of fun. And then we would take off to the science fair and clean up.
Oh no, here come those Alamos kids.
Well, it was funny because the Albuquerque Journal was a big sponsor of the science fair in New Mexico. And by rights, Los Alamos should have been in the same region as Albuquerque, but they got tired of printing all the Los Alamos names, so they had us transferred to the Northeast region. So we were competing with, you know, Raton and Las Vegas and Clayton and all these little cow towns. So,
they probably didn't like you any better.
No, they really didn't. But then we would go down to the State Science Fair in Socorro. And it was always a lot of fun. We were a good group of kids. I don't know that we were as good as the teachers thought that we were. Our main sponsor would bring us into Socorro, drop us off at the hotel, tell us when he would be doing shuttle runs back and forth to the college there for the science fair, and when we were leaving on Sunday. And then we wouldn't pretty much see him. He would just leave us on our own.
Okay.
For the weekend. It's how much trouble can you get into in Socorro, New Mexico, but
lots.
He was pretty trusting.
Okay. Nice.
So that was my big thing in high school.
Okay.
So, I did have a job. Back in the days when you weren't allowed to pump your own gas, I worked in a filling station after school in the summers.
So. In Los Alamos?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So I imagine you got to know the locals well. You know, here comes Mr. Cernicek.
Yep. He would. Well, and it was funny because some of the teachers would come to the station because I was working there. And then after I went to school, they quit going there because Chevron gas is expensive.
Oh, that's fun. And were you still, were your folks, as they had explored a ton of the Front Range there, the Rocky Mountain Front Range near Denver, did they explore Sandia Crest and Taos Box and points north, Taos? I'm just trying to think of some of the other Santa Fe, the geographical areas around Los Alamos.
We did. We would go. We went out to. We would explore around Santa Fe and Albuquerque and up towards Taos and all that kind of stuff. My folks weren't at the time and never were really interested in all of the cultural diversity in New Mexico. Los Alamos is kind of a weird town. It's like a little Midwest town stuck in the middle. my first trip to Grand Canyon was while we were living in Los Alamos.
What do you remember about that? What year was it? How old were you?
It might have been just a year or two after we got there. I think about 1967.
Okay.
So I would have been in junior high. And I do, you know, I remember, in fact, that's something I tell people on my tours today, is, you know, I've seen the Grand Canyon millions of times, but I still remember the first time I saw it.
Hmm.
Driving up to Mather Point and getting out of the car and walking up to the rim and just, like everybody else, I'd seen pictures of the canyon all along, but I was really impressed by just the vastness of it. You know, I knew what it looked like, but I didn't know it was so big. And we did it was kind of funny. When we got there, we had to stay in the overflow campground the first night, which was over about where the Maswick Lodge is today.
Okay.
And then after that, we moved to Mather. But we did the drives. We did the East Rim and the West Rim, as they were known at the time. And then my dad and I hiked down to Cedar Ridge.
Okay.
And I thought, when he said we were going for a hike, it was a mile and a half long, I thought we were going to go down to the Tonneau Plateau. I was kind of disappointed that, you know, it's kind of like, oh, we're just in the top of the Red Layers, but... On the way back out again, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, that was far enough.
yeah, coming from, Los Alamos is what, 5,000 feet, 6,000 feet?
Seven.
Okay, 7, so you had some altitude, it wasn't like you were coming from Indiana.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You had some altitude acclimatization.
Totally used to the altitude.
Okay, yeah. But still, it's a mile and a half and it's up. And that's got a really nice viewpoint there, down that Kaibab Trail. Ua Point, and even Cedar Ridge is a pretty good view.
Yeah, and the thing that I was disappointed that we weren't all the way down on the plateau, but I do remember at the same time being impressed with how far up the south rim was, looking back towards Mather Point.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, okay, we've only come a little ways down, but it's a long way back up there again. So,
and then you also mentioned Canyon de Chelly and Mesa Verde. And again, I'm assuming you guys are camping out along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Were you doing any other long hikes at that time at all?
No. My mom was not really a hiker, so. We would, as a family, we would do short hikes, a couple of miles or something like that. But that was about it.
Okay.
So, like, for example, Canyon de Chelly, we all took the White House Trail down.
Okay.
And at Mesa Verde, we would do the different cliff dwelling tours and that sort of thing. But never any really long treks. I remember in Boy Scouts, some badge or something. I had to do X number of 5 mile hikes and one 10 mile hike. And 10 miles just seems just incredibly long. It's kind of, can you really walk that far in one day? So we weren't really into long hikes.
Okay. All right. What else do you remember about life in Los Alamos?
It's a weird town.
Why? How?
It was, well, you know, it is. It's very especially at that time, the late '60s and earliest '70s when I was there. Still very much in the Cold War, everybody had a job. There was no unemployment. No poverty, no ostentatious wealth. I mean, some of the scientists were paid pretty well, but there were no aristocracy, so to speak.
Okay.
At that time, most of the housing was still government housing, although the government had divested themselves of the housing areas while I lived there, but it was still, the town was probably 90% government housing. The schools were excellent. There was no nightlife. I think there was one bar in town. And predominantly white as well. The people who worked for the lab lived in Los Alamos, and then the contractor, the Zia company, which handled the security and custodial and maintenance, you know, all that kind of stuff. Those folks who were predominantly Latino were commuting up from the valley, from Española or Milwaukee or Santa Fe. So Los Alamos itself was a very, very white town.
Okay.
And growing up there, it was kind of like, you knew it was kind of weird. And then once I went to college and could look back, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, that is just totally weird.
Huh. Okay. And so you graduated from high school what year?
1971.
The Vietnam War was raging and the draft was still in place.
Mm-hmm. I had a student deferment.
Okay.
As long as I kept my grades up for most of the time, and then my last year of real eligibility for the draft was when they switched to the lottery, and that was I've never listened to such the campus radio station carried it live.
Wow.
I listened to the whole thing. Well, not the whole thing. Once I got my birthday, but it was the longest, but yet in some ways most interesting radio program I've probably ever listened to.
Wow.
But yeah, I came up with a draft number of I think it was 256.
Okay.
And by that time, Peace with Honor was in place. And they were only expecting to draft up into the teens that year, so I was pretty safe in that regard. A friend of mine that he came up number one, so he enlisted in the Air Force the next day.
Oh wow, okay. Yeah. Was college expected of you? Was that something that your folks were, you know, you were in high school, you were gearing to go to college? Was that something that, you know, was going to happen?
It was, I had to save my money, and I was expected, what was it? I think I was expected to pay my tuition. If I couldn't pay my tuition, I couldn't go. And then my parents would cover what was left over, which with three other kids at home wasn't all that easy.
Right.
The first year I did cover my tuition, and then each year I gradually took on more and more, so that by the time I got my bachelor's degree, I was paying my own way.
Okay, and where did you? Well, when you were in a senior in high school, chemistry clearly was interesting to you.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of dropped off your love of dinosaurs, more or less.
I was very interested in chemistry, but I was abysmal at math.
Oh.
And I knew that if I was going to, you know, if it hadn't been for the math, I probably would have gone for a chemistry degree, but that I decided, no, I'm going to go for a biology degree instead.
Okay.
And, so I got a Bachelor of Science in biology, and at the time.
But there's math in biology.
There is, but the math that I had to deal with was doable.
Okay.
I had to struggle a little bit in genetics, but I eventually got the probability stuff figured out well enough that I could get through the genetics, and so it wasn't a big problem.
And where did you end up going to college?
New Mexico State.
That's I was going to say that to get the best tuition, that would have been in state.
Right. Yeah. And it was basically, you know, I had, because of science fair, I had a scholarship at New Mexico Tech in Socorro, but they just didn't really even have a biology department. Their biology was mostly to provide background courses for people in other majors. So I was pretty much a choice between New Mexico State in Las Cruces and University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And at that point, I'd already started thinking about working in natural resources for the Park Service or the Forest Service or somebody like that.
Really? How did you get that idea?
Spending all that time out there hiking around and stuff, and of course that was also, you know, the first Earth Day, and everybody wanted to be an environmentalist.
Oh, and, wow. Okay.
Some of my friends in high school were rock climbers, and even though rock climbing itself never appealed to me, being out in those kind of places did.
Hmm.
So I'd been thinking, you know, I wasn't set on it, but I'd been kind of leaning towards a career in environmental sciences in some way or another. And the biology program at UNM was more heavily laboratory type stuff, whereas New Mexico State was the land grant university, so theirs was more field oriented.
Okay.
And so I decided on New Mexico State. And went
cool.
down there, and while I was down there, at that time, they had a foreign language requirement to get a bachelor's degree, but I had taken German all the way from 7th grade through 12th grade in high school, and so had satisfied the foreign language requirement, so that transferred into more electives in my college degree. So I got my major in biology, and they didn't offer minors, but I essentially got a minor in anthropology and archaeology.
Oh, wow.
Because I did all that, had all those extra electives. And then while I was in college, that was also when I really started getting serious about trying to work for the Park Service.
And were you in, so fall of 1971, you are a freshman at University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Were you staying
New Mexico State in Las Cruces.
Oh, okay, sorry. Let me get this right. I thought, all right, so, there, you flummoxed me there, that's good. Okay, so that's in Socorro?
Las Cruces.
Las Cruces. All right, let me think about
all
this.
Way
down
south.
Okay, yep. Let's next to El Paso down near Texas.
Yep.
And it's
yep.
hot down there.
The first year I was down there, I hated the desert. Living in Colorado and then living in Los Alamos, which is pretty much like Flagstaff.
Yeah.
Pine
trees.
All of a sudden, I'm out there in the middle of the Chihuahuan Desert, and it was just awful. But by the time I graduated, I really liked it.
Okay, and so I'm thinking about were you staying in a dorm, or did you get an off-campus place to stay? How'd that work out?
I was in dorms all the way through.
Okay.
Yep, in fact, I was pretty much, except for one semester, I was in the same dorm all the way through.
That's handy.
It was kind of a, knew how it worked, and it was fine for me.
Okay, all right. Okay, so a bachelor's in biology with not quite a minor, but close enough in archaeology and anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do any summer work? Did you need a summer job? Did you have a job in the fall and the spring while you were going to school?
During the school year, I know it was my senior year, and maybe during my junior year, during the school year, I would do tutoring.
Okay.
But that's the only work that I did during the school year. During the summertime, my job in the filling station wasn't there anymore.
Right.
So I came home the first summer, and I was kind of like, okay, what am I going to do this summer? Well, I guess I can, like, work in a restaurant, or I can work in construction. Those were the two things that came to mind in Los Alamos, and I decided, you know, I'd rather work in a restaurant than out in the sun in construction in the summertime in New Mexico. So,
mm-hmm.
So I got out the Yellow Pages, and the first thing under restaurants was the snack bar in Bandelier National Monument. And so I gave them a call, and just by luck, the day before, they had somebody quit.
Wow.
That was one of the longest job searches ever, you know. So I went down and interviewed for the job, and they pretty much hired me on the spot. And so my first two summers, I worked at the snack bar in Bandelier.
What were you doing?
Taking orders, cooking hamburgers, sweeping the patio.
Okay.
And
so everything.
Yeah. It was. On a real busy weekend, there might be four of us working there, but usually two of us could hold down the shop.
Okay.
So it's changed quite a bit since then. But
tell me what you remember about Bandelier back then. This is in the summer of 1972.
Summer of 72 and summer of 73.
Okay.
And of course, I was just there in Frijoles Canyon, and.
Which canyon?
Frijoles, where the visitor center and all that stuff is.
Okay.
And I would dad's job was out at various points in the lab country there north of the monument. So we'd throw my bicycle into the back of a station wagon, and he'd drive me partway there on his way to work, and then I'd ride my bike the rest of the way down to the monument and work. And then when I got off work, I would start riding towards Los Alamos. He would start driving towards Bandelier and wherever we met up. Then he'd give me a ride the rest of the way home.
Nice.
So I'd be gone 12 hours a day, but I'd only be working about 8 or 9 of those hours.
Okay.
And also while I was there, usually before I started work, school was let out before Memorial Day, and my job really didn't start until the Memorial Day weekend, and so I went backpacking into the backcountry, and the first trip I did was with a friend of mine. Neither one of us, except for the little bit of backpacking that I'd done in Boy Scouts, neither one of us really knew anything about backpacking on our own without a scoutmaster to tell us what to do. So we just kind of made it up as we went along. And so my first backpacking trip was clear down to the southern part of the monument, a place called the Painted Cave. And I had this, you know, canvas knapsack, and I tied this Coleman flannel sleeping bag onto the bottom of it with some string. And we had our little halazone tablets. We'd frozen some hot dogs and put them in the middle of our sleeping bags so they'd stay cool so we could cook them up for supper. It was just, I look back on it, it's kind of, oh my God, what could have gone wrong on that trip? But we had a wonderful time. And so I started doing more and more day hikes and short backpacks and that kind of stuff in the backcountry of Bandelier. And it got to the point, especially my second summer there, where I knew the backcountry better than anybody in the monument except the one person trail crew that they had.
Wow.
And he usually wasn't available. So if somebody came into the visitor center and started asking questions about the backcountry, they'd send them over to the snack bar to talk to me.
Oh, cool.
Which my bosses really loved.
Yeah, it was good for business.
So it wasn't the world's greatest job. I definitely wanted to get on with the Park Service. But at the same time, it was a really good experience to be working in the park for the concessionaire there. and having a lot of friends in the Park Service, getting to see how things were working in the Park Service and that sort of thing.
So who were some of your early friends there that you met at Bandelier?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to think. Well, Mrs. Fry, who was the, she and her husband had actually started the lodge and stuff in Bandelier before it even became a national monument.
Wow.
And she was still alive at that time.
What do you remember about her?
By that time, she was, she was well up in her 80s, I think. And she was a very, very gracious old lady. And we'd see her every now and then. Her apartment was kind of up some back stairs there by the snack bar. So usually the only time I saw her was when she was going up to take her afternoon nap. But she would come in every now and then and just talk about how things were going. She was still running the curio shop. I don't know how, but she was. And she would go through. She had a little spray bottle, and every day she would go through the plaza and the rooms, because I think they still rented out a couple of rooms there, and missed all the lichens that were growing on the rocks in there, so they wouldn't die.
Oh wow.
And she would every now and then talk about old times, but I didn't know enough about the early history of Bandelier.
Yeah.
To kind of puts everything together. So she would talk about the tramway that they had built to get supplies down into the canyon and the trail out to Santa Fe and that kind of stuff. But a lot of it didn't stick because I didn't have a good frame of reference to put it with. But like I say, she was still around. And right now, I am just drawing a blank on the various folks that worked there at the time. But the superintendent, his name was Jackson. I can't remember. It's not Earl Jackson, who did a lot of writing for SPMA. That was somebody else. But I was mostly hanging out with the seasonals who came and went every year, and I'm just drawing a blank on names.
Okay.
But
I'm trying to piece this together financially. This would have been tough because you would have made maybe just enough to make tuition, but as in-state, it wouldn't have been that much.
Right. It was. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking tuition, room, and board was almost $700 a semester. So, it was pretty appalling when I sent my boys to school and their first semester cost as much as my entire degree did.
Yeah.
But it was a case of it wasn't – working at the snack bar, I was making a little bit more than I made at the filling station, but not a lot more.
Right.
I was living at home, and you know, all those expenses were covered and that sort of thing. But it wasn't until the summer after my junior year when I started working for the Park Service that I could really, you know, then I was a GS-4 and making over twice as much as I'd made in the snack bar.
And as a tutor for New Mexico State, that would have basically taken a big chunk out of that $700.
Not all that. They paid us by the hour.
Oh, okay.
And it was a, So it helped, but it wasn't a big source of income.
Okay. All right. Because, you know, like today, I mean, if you tutor, they take, you know, vast chunks out of your tuition. But if they were doing it by the hour there, that'd be very different. So.
Yeah. And it was. In fact, as I think about it, I'm thinking I may not have even been working for, I don't think I was. I think I was, it was actually a program that the Biological Honorary Society put together.
Oh, oops. And, no funding there. Hmm.
Yeah, so it was pretty minuscule.
Okay. So let's pick this thread up in 72, 73. So it'd be 1974. You got a summer job working for the Park Service. How did that come about?
Well, my winter break routine, I'd come home from college. We'd have Christmas within a few days, because that's just the way the schedule worked out. And then once that was out of the way, I would get out my typewriter and start filling out SF-171s. And in those days, you could apply to as many parks for seasonal positions as you wanted to. And I would apply for seasonal jobs to between 30 and 40 different parks.
Wow.
Every year. It was considered at that time very bad form to send in a photocopy. So everyone was a hand-typed 171. And the first 2 years, nothing happened. But the third year, I sent out all my forms, and then over spring break in 74, a friend of mine and I, for our spring break trip, hiked to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and spent a couple nights at the old Bright Angel campground, back when it was just a flat field of dirt. And when I came out, called home, told my folks, you know, we're out alive. And they said, oh, Petrified Forest wants to talk to you. And so I called him up. And,
all right, wait. Before we get to Petrified Forest,
okay.
Let's go back and talk about what you remember about that spring hike to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Is this still with the canvas backpack and the Coleman sleeping bag hanging below it, going bang, bang, bang into your low back every step?
Nope. I at that point, I'm trying to think. I had gotten a backpack.
Like aluminum frame Kelty kind of thing?
Aluminum frame Walmart kind of thing.
Okay.
Walmart then. So it was an aluminum frame, anodized green, with the pack body was this heavy duty nylon.
Okay.
With green and white stripes, and then the flap was dark green. You remember the Greek letter? Epsilon? It's the oval with the bar across the middle of it that was kind of an environmental symbol. So one of those right in the middle of the pack flap.
Huh, okay.
And, I had that. I'd gotten that already because of the backpacking that I'd done in Bandelier. And so for that trip, I'd saved up my money and splurged on a down sleeping bag from REI that I still own. That was when I became a member of REI. So that was my one piece of professional, so to speak, backpacking equipment. And still cans of Sterno and hot dogs.
Okay.
Roasted. No, we had dehydrated food. That's right, because my buddy messed it up. So we couldn't get a ride out to the Kaibab Trailhead, so we hiked up and down the Bright Angel. We left, and there was about, a foot of snow on the ground. And we went on down, and of course, by the time we got to the bottom, it was nice and warm. We stopped for lunch, but pretty much just hiked straight down to the bottom of the canyon. And at that time, Bright Angel Campground was just this, you know, flat plain left by the CCC with a couple of outhouses sitting in the middle of it and some picnic tables scattered around. And so
at that time, I'm trying to remember, it was right around that time, maybe it was a couple of years before, that the park started the permit system at Bright Angel.
Right.
And
right.
They did it with a lottery to start. And then they just to kind of jumpstart this concept, they used the lottery. They closed the whole thing down. And did lottery, and then they went into the permit system. So when you went down there, did you have to go find the backcountry office to get a permit?
I had corresponded with the backcountry office. And
okay.
What we had wanted to do was, we'd wanted to go, I'd written them a letter, because, of course, there was no online stuff or anything
right.
like that. I'd written them a letter. I said, we want to spend a night at Phantom Ranch. We want to spend a night at Roaring Springs, a night at Phantom Ranch, and out. And I don't remember how it all worked out, but we eventually wound up with a permit for two nights at Phantom Ranch. And then when I got home, after the whole trip was over, I had a letter from the backcountry office where they'd given us a night at Indian Gardens, a night at Phantom Ranch, and a night at Indian Gardens. But I didn't know about it. So it was completely screwed up. It wasn't what I had applied for, because what I applied for, the Learning Space Campground was either already closed or it was still closed for the winter.
Was that Cottonwood? Or further up at the Aikens place up there?
It was at the picnic area at Roaring Springs is where that campground was.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, like I said, I can't remember if that campground had already been permanently closed. It was just, no, we're not going to have people camp here anymore, or if it was just that we were early enough in the season that it wasn't open yet. So
you asked for a night at Phantom, a night at Roaring Springs, a night at Phantom, and you got three nights at Phantom?
No, what we got, but I didn't know at the time, was a night at Indian Garden, a night at Phantom, and a night at Indian Garden.
So you were not where you were supposed to be on night one. Did anybody care? Did anybody check the look?
No, when I went to the backcountry office, when we got to the park, I went to the backcountry office. And they said, no, we don't have a permit for you. And I was able to get two nights at Phantom.
Okay. Oh, I see. All right.
So we were permitted for the two nights that we had at Phantom, but apparently we were also permitted for those other nights, but we never picked it up. So hopefully somebody else got those.
Night. So what do you remember about that? Two nights at Phantom. What did you do in your intervening day there?
Well, mostly suffered. We walked up the end of the box for a ways. Don't remember how far, but once we had gotten down, since we pretty much hiked nonstop, I was really tired, and so I plopped down at the picnic table. And while I was sitting there, my muscles all completely froze up.
Oh, gee.
And so the next day, I could hardly walk. I wasn't blistered, but my muscles it was a terminal Kaibab shuffle.
Hmm.
And so we hobbled up the North Kaibab into the box. Looking back on it, we were probably pretty close to the end of it, although we didn't know that at the time.
Hmm. Okay.
And then we came back down and then hiked out the last day. The night we were, I can't remember if it was the first night or the second night, but we're cooking our dehydrated food, and I was kind of the chief cook, so it was chicken and dumplings sort of thing. So I had heated up the chicken, and I had just put the dumplings in, and I told my friend to watch it while I ran to stand in line at the outhouse. I came back, and he had stirred the dumplings into the chicken stew.
Ooh.
So the whole thing had set up as kind of this gelatinous mass, and we ate as much of it as we could, but there was just no way we could choke down the whole thing. And so I thought, well, we'll just leave the pan in the rocks, and it'll probably be empty in the morning. And it was.
Oh, gosh.
So kind of like, okay, now I kind of cringe to think about that, but it seemed like a reasonable solution at the time.
It did. It worked.
Yeah, it did.
Yep.
And then our day out hike, we were both sore, although my friend wasn't nearly so sore as I was. And we thought, well, we're going to get an early start, and we did. And so we were out of the canyon by like 2 in the afternoon or something
nice.
Like that. Yeah, it's like, okay, now what are we going to do? So we were camped at Mather.
And there was snow at the top.
There was snow. It had melted off while we were gone, so it wasn't a complete snow cover anymore.
Okay.
But that plastic tube tent that we had was not all that much shelter, so it was a good thing that it was reasonably good weather for, I think, March. And then called my folks, found out that Petrified wanted to talk to me. And, of course, to get from Grand Canyon down to Las Cruces, you just drive Highway 180 all the way, which goes right by Petrified Forest anyway.
That's today's Interstate 40?
No, it that 180 down from the canyon, and then when you get, it's Interstate 40 from Flagstaff to Holbrook.
Yep.
And then in Holbrook, it takes off to the southwest, drops down through Springerville and Alpine, and then down to Silver City, Deming in southern New Mexico, and then over to Las Cruces.
Right.
And eventually goes over to Guadalupe Mountains and Carlsbad Caverns.
Okay.
So, in fact, in the old days, it used to be called the National Park Highway.
Oh, interesting.
But it probably wasn't the only one called that. But
yeah.
Anyway. So, you know, just a little side trip on the way home. So I go in and talk to the guys, and they toured me around, and it was they had a position for me in the entrance station and toured me around headquarters. They all thought it was really amusing when I had to slide down the banister to get downstairs. So they offered me the job. And
like right there, right then?
Yep, yep. They said, okay, yep, we're gonna hire you. And so I'm headed home, and we didn't know. We took I-40 from Holbrook up to the north end of the park where headquarters was.
Right.
And I don't remember if it didn't occur to us or if we just didn't know about driving through the park to pick up 180 at the south end of the park.
Oh, interesting.
Cruise us. So we drove back into Holbrook and then back out.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
At the south end of the park. And I remember driving through Holbrook and thinking, oh, my God, this is my town.
Mm.
kind of horrified. But, you know, it worked. And so I was real excited. And that was my first summer with the Park Service, was in the Painted Desert Entrance Station at the north end of Petrified Forest.
And right there, we've been going for about 1 hour and 7 minutes. And I'm like, maybe this would be a good place to stop this first one part, and we will pick it up again.
Okay.
With your first summer there at Petrified National Forest.
Okie dokie, that sounds good. And you just made the mistake that everybody makes: Petrified Forest National Park.
Thank you, and you'll keep correcting me until I get it right.
Well, we used to get letters, you know, Petrified National Forest State Park, and stuff. I was in charge of answering the tourist mail, and you'd be amazed. But anyway.
Petrified Forest National Park. All right.
Yep.
I'll get it right. It's just, you'll train me. Maybe I'll get a seasonal job there in the summer. I'll be at the entrance station. This will be good.
Yeah.
I'll get it right.
Yeah.
Okay, and this was just following the dateline here, 1974. Great. All right, before we wrap up this, what is now going to be part one interview, is there anything else you want to add to this as you've been talking, going, oh, I didn't talk about that story that happened either in grade school or high school or college before that 1974 summer at Petrified?
Not really that I can think of.
Okay.
After we hang up, I'll probably come up with something. But
and then we'll bring that up back in part two. But just before we wrap up part one, that's how we'll sort that out. Okay, excellent.
That sounds good.
Well, in that case, this will conclude part one, Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Carl Bowman. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Monday, November 2nd, 2020. And Carl, thank you so very much.
Well, my pleasure.